Today's podcast is brought to you by Zipcar.com. Earn $25 of free driving credit at joinzipcar.com/filmwaxradio. This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio. This is episode number 356 of the podcast. Well, I'm here at the Showbriz Studios in the East Village, and this is the first, actually, time, even though I've been in the studio a number of times now, at least half a dozen times or so with guests, this is the first time I'm recording an intro, like the intro to the show, so it's a seminal moment for listeners. And joining me, which is also this is unusual. Yeah, put they're right in front of your mouth, right there. She put on her headphones. I'm talking to Charlotte Williams, who is interning for FilmWax Radio this summer.
Hello.
Thank you, by the way.
Of course.
Don't be shy.
Happy to help.
Just chime in whenever, but we'll talk about you in a second. I just want to set up the show. This is a very special episode. There's two segments coming up. One is with the filmmakers of I use the word seminal already, so I can't use it again, but it's a classic documentary short called Heavy Metal Parking Lot. And what these guys did, I guess this is in 1986, they went to these two filmmakers, their names are Jeff Krulik and John Hine, and they went to I forget the name of they call it the Capitol Center. That's what it's called because they call it the Cap Center. And it's an arena or stadium in, I think it's, you know, it's in Maryland. So maybe it's outside in Baltimore. I should know this, but anyway, they go to a Judas Priest. Do you know that? You know them? Judas Priest. Anyway, just people can't see that expression. You have to answer with use your words.
I'm not familiar.
I know, and you're not comfortable on the mic. I understand, so don't worry about it. Anyway, Charlotte's interning for the podcast, so she's. I put her on the spot a little bit, so you feel okay?
I do.
Okay,
I feel fine.
Okay, go ahead. And your parents can listen to. Cause that's how we know each other. I worked with your dad years ago.
Hi, Dad.
Hi, Don. Because of his AOL. Messenger name was D. Will at Arc, or something like that, because he's an architect.
Arc, yeah.
And so I would always call him Dwill. That was my pet name.
Never heard that.
Anyway, so these filmmakers, to get back to the story, they go to this parking lot. They think, let's shoot the, what do they call it? When people go to a game early and they
get
drunk, tailgating parties.
Yes.
So they go to, they have a tailgating, they're going to go and they're going to interview these teenagers who are going to this heavy metal, they're heavy metal band. Judas Priest is a heavy metal band.
Okay.
They're a classic heavy metal band from the 80s. Although, for all I know, they're still, you know, maybe in their latest incarnation. But back then they were maybe up at the top of the food chain of metal all bands,
right.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And these kids, they're like in high school, I'm pretty sure, and they all go to. And so they're interviewing all these kids that are really wasted, and so they just point the cameras at them, ask regular questions, and the kids answer, and it's really entertaining. I mean,
I'm sure it is.
It is really
sure.
Well. I'll get you. I'll make sure. I have a copy. I'll let
I'd
you.
Love
you
to
can.
See it.
It's only 18 minutes long, and
all
it's
right.
But it for some reason it just has grown into this thing. This is they're still celebrating 30 years later now. They're having their 30th anniversary. They did a screening at South by Southwest this past March.
Mm-hmm.
I met with Jeff and John, the filmmakers there, and we knocked out this podcast segment that's coming up in a minute. And then there's also celebrating in Maryland at some museum. They're doing a gallery exhibition of the stills taken from the heavy metal parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
There have been all sorts of sequels and follow-ups and reunions. I mean, it's a whole culture around this documentary, short. And they're doing a 30th anniversary screening at the Anthology Film Archives. We just had on Brent Barber, who will be on the next episode of the podcast, who is the founding director of the Bicycle Film Festival, which is taking place next week at the Anthology Film Archives. So, so it's busy over there in the Anthology Film Archives, but they're doing a 30th anniversary on June 18th, coming right up in a day or two, of Heavy Metal Parking Lot. Right. And John and Jeff will be there. So I wanted to make sure that this podcast went up in time to help promote that event. Check the Anthology Film Archives or the Heavy Metal Parking Lot website for more information. And you got to see the film. If you're listening and you haven't seen Heavy Metal Parking Lot, you got to see this. It's a great – it's available. I don't know where, but it's available online somewhere. You can see it. Mm-hmm. It's so fun to watch, and it's like a – it's a little snapshot of time, you know, at a particular – the other guest is – it's also musically oriented, but it couldn't be further – is Morgan Neville, who is an old friend of the podcast. He's been on before, and he has this film about Yo-Yo Ma. The documentary is basically a bit about a Yo-Yo Ma and his background, but it's also about this period of time where he's assembling this international group of musicians called the Silk Road Ensemble. So right. The name of the film is actually Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble. That's the name of the documentary. And it's currently in theaters, and it's opening wider in the coming weeks. But it's currently playing in New York and in Los Angeles as this podcast goes up. So you can see it right now. And it'll be, of course, available in more towns and cities around the country, or world for all I know, in the coming weeks. It's really, really beautiful film. And you get to know Yo-Yo Ma. And it's funny because, Charlotte, stop interrupting. I'm kidding. I just feel like.
No, I'm sorry. Now, you know, I'm still getting used to this podcast environment, so
I know.
Forgive
did you
me.
Ever think that no. you finished your first year at school?
Yes,
in theater, an undergrad at the
University of Minnesota,
mm-hmm. St. Paul,
Minneapolis.
I'm sorry,
no
and then all of a sudden you're podcasting days after finishing your first year. But thank you. So where was I now? I've interrupted myself. Oh, usually I do this podcast and I do it at home alone, mm-hmm. you know, and so. Now it feels, since you're in here with me, that yeah. I feel like I'm actually talking too much, even though...
Oh, I don't think you're talking... Maybe I'm talking too little, but I don't think you're
no.
talking too much.
Well, I'm setting up the show. I sure. mean, I have to. So anyway.
It's your job.
It is. But I always want somebody mm-hmm. when I do it. I listen to other podcasts, too, and you know, there's always like a co-host or... It's lonely doing the podcast. So this is much more fun. Anyway, that, I just wanted to set up those two segments first and foremost. Thank you for that. So just to finish up with Morgan, Morgan's been on the podcast before. He got, you know, he's an Oscar-winning documentary filmmaker. Did you see, Charlotte, 20 Feet from Stardom?
I did not, but I've heard of it and know yeah. it is
it's spectacular.
Well received.
Yeah,
so
you should try to see it.
Take a look at it.
It's a really entertaining documentary yeah. about backup singers.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I think I've definitely seen segments and know that it's mm-hmm. gotten quite a bit of, you know,
yeah,
word renown.
Yeah,
and,
it has.
Yeah,
he's a very, very skilled filmmaker, Morgan. And I had him on the show with 20 Feet from Stardom. It ended up winning the Oscar, and that was fantastic. And then he subsequently did another film, which he actually told me in this upcoming interview today, that he had shot beforehand, which was a relationship with these two intellectuals, let's put them in, writers and personalities, which is called Best of Enemies. Alex, I was telling you about this, right? Right? I was telling you about Best of Enemies. It was, it's Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley Jr. And, you know, they just hated each other's guts.
Right.
But they often appeared together in public or, yeah. you know, on TV because mm-hmm. they people loved watching them, like, tear each other apart. And this is before, you know, the advent of reality TV or reality TV.
I mean, pre-Jerry Springer.
Or just CNN. Or, no, but even if you watch cable news, they always have, you know, like eight people on and they're all screaming at each other mm-hmm. or over each other, much like what's happening here in the studio right now. So Morgan made that documentary called Best of Enemies, and it's great, too. So finally now here, this is his, he's cleared the table with this new documentary. It's called, again, Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble. So we're going to talk to Morgan on the show. So let's go right now into my conversation with Morgan Neville about his new documentary, which is currently in theaters.
The clearest reason for music, for culture, is it gives us meaning. We started as an idea
group of musicians getting together and seeing what might happen when strangers meet. We scoured from Venice to Istanbul, Central Asia, China, and Mongolia, looking for incredible talent.
American orchestra. That's very interesting.
This was like the Manhattan Project of music. No one knew what was going to happen.
I knew there was going to be naysayers.
You're taking this traditional music, mixing together and diluting these traditions.
Arts is about opening up to possibility. Possibility links to hope. We all need hope.
I'm always trying to figure out how I fit in the world, which I think is something that I share with 7 billion other people.
Morgan?
How's it going?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks.
Turning the recorder is going, so FYI.
Okay.
So anything you...
Wearing.
Oh, no, you can swear. absolutely swear. But, you know...
Nothing incriminating.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. No, and certainly nothing disparaging about, I don't know...
Donald Trump.
Donald Trump, no. Again, that's two for two here. No, by all means. I'm thinking of changing this podcast, actually, to one that swears up at Donald Trump. I'm talking about singing to the choir. Yeah, no, exactly. I'd be singing, I think I'd be singing to the choir here. It's funny, I was at Brick Arts Media. Are you familiar with that place? It's an arts organization in downtown Brooklyn. One of the things they run is that they're most known for is Celebrate Brooklyn, an outdoor music series in Prospect Park at the Band Shell. But they do, They have a whole studio and resources and, you know. Anyway, I was in there about 6-7 months ago because I did a bunch of TV things for them. And I was there early and I was getting a coffee in their little cafe. And you know, I worked at Sony Music for years. So I amassed quite a bit of Yo-Yo Ma. See, we come to the point. Music, I guess in my head, I just had this Yo-Yo Ma from 15 years ago. And I'm standing there, and there's Yo-Yo Ma. I didn't 100% know it was him, though. I was like, I think it could be him, but it's not him. Anyway, it was, and I didn't say anything about it. But he was just being kibitzy and funny and kind of nerdy, and I thought it was charming. But and then I
exactly. No, he's very charming. That is way, and very unassuming. Yeah, I think Yo-Yo said that, you know, when he travels through an airport carrying a cello, he's Yo-Yo Ma. But when he travels to an airport with...
He's what?
A Chinese tourist.
Oh, a Chinese tourist. Yeah.
He kind of becomes invisible.
Is he suggesting that all Chinese people look alike? No. That would be terrible. That would make no sense.
Actually, the thing I feel bad for is Chinese cellists who aren't Yo-Yo, who...
Right.
Probably been mistaken for him. Yeah.
That's probably, and that was probably the origin of that stereotype. Yeah. All Chinese cellists look alike. Yeah.
But look like Yo-Yo Ma.
Yeah. Anyway, he is charming, and he comes across just as charmingly in your film, The Music of Strangers, I think it's called.
Yes.
That's the short version.
Fine.
Is there an imperative for you while you're on this trajectory of making more popular documentaries to become more prolific? Because it seems like you're on a bit of a tear. I think it was maybe 3 summers ago or 3 falls ago you came out with 20 Feet from Stardom, right? Which...
Yeah, 3 summers ago.
Which I think won the Oscar. But would you know about that?
I would. I have evidence on my mantle.
Congratulations. I don't think I got a chance to tell you that.
No, it's fine.
And then there's, of course, The Best of Enemies, which came out subsequently. And now, within 3 years, you have the Yo-Yo Ma documentary about his putting together this ensemble of international musicians. And it must have taken quite a bit of time. So I'm just wondering if you feel like you have to ride the momentum of this recent chapter of success.
Well, I mean, the reality of it is that I started both Best of Enemies and Music of Strangers before I finished 20 Feet. So, I mean, it's something very typical in being an independent filmmaker. You're always working on 5 films at once. And the reality of it was the success of 20 Feet allowed me to raise enough money to finish all the other films I was working on.
Right.
So that's why suddenly there was you know, a bunch of stuff coming out because I was able to clean off the shelves.
That makes a lot of that makes a lot of sense.
That being said, the shelves are bare now, so I don't have any more half finished documentaries that are going to come out next year. So I kind of I did my house cleaning and I got to finish everything I was working on, and now I'm kind of now starting to look ahead and say, you know, what do I want to do next?
That sort of seems like it's both exciting but also a little bit unnerving, maybe. But to get to the current film, which I think is it opening today?
Yeah, opens today.
And you gave me all this time? You know you were doing, we're supposed to be on for an hour
I've
and
got
a half.
Nothing to do.
Okay, we're supposed to be on for an hour and a half. You know that, right? breathe easy now. No, actually, I won't take a lot.
I don't want to hear myself that long.
But you did, and then thank you again also for, you did that Montclair Film Festival Live podcast with me too, which...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which against all technical odds, came off quite well. I think you were at in Toronto.
Exactly, exactly. No, and you're part of the Montclair Mafia.
And me?
I don't know. Are you?
No.
Where are you based?
No. I'm in New York. I'm in the city. That was me trying to... And I'll be very brief about it. But I'm trying to create, some sort of way of getting into doing what I do with certain festivals. And so I approached, you know, Tom Hall, who I'm friendly with, and that was a nice one. And I did one with Rooftop. And I've since now, you know, I'm getting a little bit of things going. So I remember, again, as I said at the beginning of our conversation, that I was working at Sony Music, which Sony Classical was one of course, our labels.
Yeah.
And my position wasn't at the label, but I would get all the, you know, a lot of his music, as well as many other artists, of course. But I saw that he started to do these compilations, Appalachian Waltz, this thing, these different Appalachian albums. And then he moved on to the Silk Road projects, because he started this quite a while ago, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think... The kind of the trajectory we talk about in the movie, he starts, you know, he goes to Botswana and kind of has this epiphany about wanting to try different things. And right after that, he does a Bobby McFerrin, but then he does Astro Piazzolla, Ennio Morricone, and starts Silk Road and, you know, the Goat Rodeo. So, I mean, this is all kind of manifestations of a similar impulse of his, which is, try and figure out what he can do with music that's both about understanding the world and trying to change the world for the better.
But isn't it also, and this is maybe something you felt since you won the Oscar, that all of a sudden you realize, oh, there's a world of choices that is opening up to me. In other words, Yo-Yo Ma being one of the most recognizably talented and successful musicians worldwide, you know, I don't have to be boxed into doing specific concertos and a certain type of genre of music. I actually could step out and do whatever I want to have, and I've never really taken advantage of it.
But I don't actually think that's the impulse for him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he certainly had that freedom, but the thing is, there are a lot of very successful people in the classical music world who never leave the classical music world. And there were a lot of these collaborations and things he tried that I guarantee you the label and the managers did not think were a good business idea. You know, I think that for him it was about experimenting, but he caught a lot of flack for it from people because, you know, he never turned his back on his core work and the work that he continues to do, mm-hmm. but it certainly, you know, people kind of started to, you know, and I've gone back and read plenty of the reviews of people saying, you know, oh, what's Yo-Yo up to now? You know, he's kind of, you know, flitting about playing with, you know, musicians in strange costumes and everybody everywhere. And you know, I don't think
mm-hmm.
it was done for any other reason other than he was curious.
Understood.
And he wanted to try something different.
It makes sense. And then he does, of course, because of what I was referring to before in terms of his stature, he does have all these options then to actually, it's much easier for somebody like him to, of course, immerse himself and not just like go to the next neighborhood over in Queens where, you know, there's a Romanian, you know, enclave, but he can actually go to Romania, you know, or whatever, I mean, the country is. And
no,
I mean,
he definitely spent some of his, you know, capital, you know, his,
right.
you know, popularity capital to
sure.
things like this that people said, okay, Yo-Yo, if you want to do it, you know, we'll do it. I mean, the amount of effort that went into this first Silk Road kind of gathering in 2000 was huge. You know, it took 2 years of planning and, you know, a lot of money and a lot of volunteers, and everybody basically trusted Yo-Yo.
Mm-hmm. Did you travel with him through the entire time?
I did. I mean, I started the film 5 years ago, so basically over the last 5 years,
mm-hmm.
I followed what he's been doing and did, you know, I went with him to, you know, China and Turkey and Europe and around America to see him. I mean, there's something in the film where his son says that he doesn't just believe his job is what happens on stage. He believes his job happens when he lands in a place and doesn't stop. And
yeah,
I can
right.
attest to the fact that being with Yo-Yo on the road, it doesn't matter if he's talking to the bellboy or the taxi driver or the president of that country. He's always kind of fully engaged.
That's exactly right. It was an interesting observation, which really did belong in the film. You know, it really kind of gave us a great insight into Yo-Yo Ma, more than just being, oh, here's this very friendly, warm guy. I mean, the way he comes across on screen can't be artificial. I mean, you know, he's and then to know that he's just so present, it says a lot, you know, about him.
No, it does. I mean, he was talking to me about it actually last week. We're talking about
the son or Yo-Yo Ma.
Yeah, I was talking to Yo-Yo last week about some of this. We were talking about fear, and he was saying that the best way, you know, he had some stage fright, and he used to throw up before he'd go on stage.
Really?
Touring and anxiety, and he'd be critiqued, and he said basically his way of kind of coping with all this was to kind of instill in himself such an overwhelming amount of kind of passion and love. And he said love is the antidote to fear, you know, just bursting at the seams to kind of share what he was doing and believing in it so mm-hmm. much that became the thing that finally, you know, freed him from fear. And it comes across. I mean, that takes a tremendous amount of energy to do it. And I'm actually, just from having spent a lot of time with him, always amazed that he has the energy he does, because it's hard to keep up with him.
Where do you think he gets that reserve? What is that?
God, I wish.
He doesn't party.
Oh, he can party.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, in fact, finishing our shoot in Turkey, and the last night we went to a restaurant on rooftop in Istanbul. And at the end of the night, everybody had left except for a PA and, you know, a waiter and Yo-Yo and a couple of us sitting around a hookah, you know, with a bottle of wine. He didn't want to go home. You know, mm-hmm. people were trying to drag him out. He was going to keep going.
When he does do these projects and he steps out of the classical, maybe you don't know, but what is the response of the classical music community? Is there a judgment against such things? I don't know. You know, of course, the assumption is that the classical community is a bit snobbish about other types of music, and that classical music really is the only music worth, you know.
Sure. I mean, my sense of it is that in the early days, there was a lot more
resistance,
resistance and snobbishness about what he was doing, and now it's kind of mm-hmm. changed into acceptance, or maybe even approval.
Yeah, you know, let's face it. I say this a little bit of as a devil's advocate, because I know that when I was there, Sony Classical, there was like the jazz label shut down. Sony Classical was always hanging on by, you know, however many threads. Peter, what the heck's his last name again? Peter, who he was the president of the label, he went over to Carnegie Hall, it was just it's always been there's always been a death knell around the corner for the classical music recording industry.
Well, and this is actually, you know, one of the points of the movie. It's funny because these kind of guardians of purity and tradition exist in every culture. It's not just that they exist in classical music, but they exist in, you know, Persian culture and Chinese
right.
culture.
Yeah.
There are people, critics in those countries saying, you know, to all the other musicians in the Silk Road, you know, what are you doing playing with Western musicians, or what are you doing, you know, with Lumon, you know, playing with Philip Glass and the Kronos Quartet? You know, that's not what you're supposed to be doing. But I think the kind of one of the big arguments of the film is that tradition is not just doing something and repeating it as redundantly as possible forever. Mm-hmm. Not the point of tradition. The point of, you know, tradition comes from innovation, and it succeeds and continues to thrive through innovation. And I think one of the great things about this metaphor of the Silk Road is this idea that things that seem so pure, in fact, have been influenced by other cultures going back millennia. So there's actually kind of a fallacy of purity going on. And you can talk about the, you know, pure Chinese instruments or pure Persian instruments or Western instruments, and I guarantee you there are connections between why a pipa and a lute are connected, or a sitar and a guitar are connected, or a kamache and a violin are connected. You know, that's, these things that seem pure to certain cultures are already interconnected to other cultures.
Well, there's some wonderful examples and demonstrations of the music that from the Silk Road Project that are in the film, which really are gorgeous, and was really a lovely little gift. Turn up the music and really enjoy watching these guys play.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. I mean, it was amazing for me to be able to just...
I'm sure it was.
...to document it. Mm-hmm. I learned so much making this film.
Oh, yeah. I imagine you must have, yeah. L. Peter Gelb was the former president of Sony Classical. Every time I hear his name, I always hear it in the voice of Mel Brooks. And you're laughing, but there is a reason for that.
Why, they grew up in the same neighborhood?
Very possibly, but that's not why. I was working there at Sony, and one day there was an old, short man facing the elevator banks, and he was sort of scratching his head, body language-wise, and he turned around, and he looked at me, and he goes, "That's Peter Gelb. What floor is he on?" And, of course, it was Mel Brooks, and because they were producing his the soundtrack or the original Broadway cast album for the producers, So I was like, here, let me carry you upstairs, you know, let me take you. Oh, I got off at the wrong floor. I'm sorry. It's the other. No, I was just, and it was on two occasions, and I was also just too starstruck. It was an occasion where I was just too starstruck. Maybe a little bit like with Yo-Yo Ma.
Mel Brooks is a very good one.
That is a good one. All right. Well, thank you. Well, the music
sure.
is... Well, give me the full title. The Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma, and the Silk Road Project. What is it called?
Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma, and the Silk Road Ensemble.
Ensemble. Okay, so it's the name of the film is Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble. It's opening today in New York, anyway, on June 10th, which might be a little bit, maybe that was yesterday or the day before when I finally get this up. I apologize that I missed our appointment earlier this week. And
No problem. I know how it goes.
Yeah, I was biting off a lot, and I've been working in Brooklyn. Never mind. And where else is it opening today? How many cities?
In the next couple of weeks, it's opening kind of all over. You know,
yeah, makes sense.
All major cities.
Gotcha. Well, Morgan, let's do it again next time. It's great.
Sounds great.
I always love talking to you.
You as well.
Thanks.
Take care now.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
For you, the listeners of FilmWax Radio, Zipcar is offering $25 of free driving credit at zipcar.com. Oh, sure, you could call for one type of cab or another, one sort of taxi company to pick you up, but isn't it better to be the driver of the car that you're and drive yourself to your appointments? To earn $25 of free driving credit, go to joinzipcar.com/filmwaxradio. Again, that's joinzipcar.com/filmwaxradio to earn free driving credit. Music on this podcast is from San Francisco area based singer and songwriter and an old friend of mine from way, way back, Lane Arieh. That's Lane, L-A-N-E, R-E-A, A-R-Y-E, from his recent album, Thunder Echoes. You can find his album on Amazon and CD Baby and other places where music is sold. So thank you, Lane, and if you're interested, please do check out Lane's music. He's a very talented musician indeed. We many years ago when we knew each other better, we used to kind of inspire one another, I believe. So thank you, Lane, for creating such beautiful music, and I'm glad for the opportunity to play some of it. That was, again, Morgan Neville, and that was his third time on the podcast. The second time, when he was talking about Best of Enemies, I forgot to mention this when I was talking to Charlotte, but that we did a live podcast because Best of Enemies was about to screen in Montclair, the Montclair Film Festival last year, and I did a live podcast celebrating the Montclair Film Festival, and Morgan was on that panel, except that he was in, I think, at Hot Docs in Toronto when that happened. So he kindly Skyped in. And so that was great. And so this is his third appearance. And so thank you, Morgan. Next up here again is the filmmakers behind the classic documentary called Heavy Metal Parking Lot, which is enjoying its 30th anniversary. Again, take a look on their website. Figure out where you can see this film. It is so entertaining. And I highly recommend it. It's must-see viewing for the FilmWax community of listeners. So right now, my conversation with Jeff Krulik and John Hine and their documentary, Heavy Metal Parking Lot.
I'm Dave Helby. I'm 20 years old. I'm ready to rock.
What's your name?
Graham, man. Like Graham a dude.
Yeah.
Hell yeah!
Heavy metal rules!
I've never seen such thing in all my life.
He said, oh, we don't say okay. Anything. Hold it. Yeah. Okay. Good. No, no, no. Okay. Sure. Sure. Well, I'm just undoing my shoelaces so my dogs can breathe. Ah, no. I had a eureka moment, kind of that. I had this just moment of clarity yesterday where I realized this, what the South by Southwest experience is all about, and because I didn't know this was our first time here.
Right.
Both John and I have not been to South by Southwest before, so
okay.
This was something we kind of we were invited, and you know, after some discussion back and forth, and people who were in the business were really that were complimentary and just saying, you know, they were just so impressed that we got here, and I kind of didn't really register. Like you're mentioning, the agent and having people, publicists, trying to get their clients here. And I know somebody who is a publicist, and she was really saying how that's so great. She's got clients who really want to be able to come here and talk, such as Leonard Maltin, which is where we were going with this discussion. We were saying, how did he get here? Well, maybe he has his agent involved. Who knows? But yesterday, it was just walking around with Jamie Chavotkin, our distributor, our agent, if you will. He and I were just kind of going back and forth, exchanging ideas on the street as we're walking around, and just things were just kind of popping into my head, and it just all of a sudden clicked.
Eureka.
What?
Eureka.
I'm sorry?
Eureka.
Eureka! I had my eureka moment, and it was just, oh my God, this! I understood what the kind of appeal is, and the kind of the energy level, this exchange of ideas going back and forth, and God, I just felt like my batteries were being recharged.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
It was a neat kind of revelation to me that it totally it just clicked that why this is such an important week and an important destination for people to come to, and you know, all across the spectrum of the industry. And I'm a believer now.
so you've drank the Kool-Aid.
You could say that, yes.
All right. Well,
I'm Jeff Krulik, and yes. I'm sitting next to
John Hine.
Hold it, John. The microphone. You know, John and I made Heavy Metal Parking Lot, and it's our 30th anniversary. We're having the official launch, the official kickoff to our 30th anniversary year is being launched right here at South by Southwest 2016.
Have you been approached by other theaters in festivals about doing 30th anniversaries?
Well, now we are. We're holding off and kind of announcing our intentions and our idea to really commemorate this year. We wanted to use South by Southwest as the launching point.
That makes sense.
And we put out a big email blast and have just really gone public.
I think I was on that blast.
I'm sure. Yeah. And we're happy that you are interested. I mean, we've kind of talked back and forth over the years now, and it just works now that we've had a chance here to meet up at South by Southwest.
And I'm really glad for it. I think I was doing a series called Docularius.
That's right.
Up at the Maisel Cinema in Manhattan, up in Harlem. Al Maisel's, office is upstairs, and they have like a storefront cinema downstairs. And I was programming a series called Docularius, which was my idea, which was, funny docs or docs about funny things and humorous things. And because I think there's not enough of that. And this was a natural, and so I contacted you at some point just because I thought what a perfect addition that would be, and then eventually maybe when you guys were coming through New York, we could maybe do something like that. And so, but anyway, this is
That might have been a few years back.
It was probably around the 25th.
Okay. In fact, every 5 years, we've kind of cooked up a way to kind of commemorate and celebrate the milestone of the marker of Heavy Metal Parking Lot being another, 5 years older, and so the 25th, 20th, what
sure.
have you. I guess we started around the 15th in 2001.
Yeah, right. I guess 10 is enough.
We probably did something. For the 10th. For the 10th is when we did Neil Diamond Parking Lot. We went and did a sequel. But the whole thing is just, nobody's more astonished and grateful at the path of this than John and I. We're really, really pleased that we're here now talking about this short film 30 years later. And
it's like 18 minutes. How long?
It's 17 minutes.
17 minutes.
Yeah. It's a short, It's not even a feature.
Yeah, I know.
What's that?
I know. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It's, so,
well,
so, No, but it's kind of remarkable I can't think of another short that has that pop culture significance. Many other, obviously, feature-length docs, but I don't think there is one that's a short that would, for instance, have a 30th anniversary at a major international festival like South by.
Yeah.
It's hard for us, it's hard to really keep that in perspective. And that being here is a real wake up call. Yeah, we're totally we're like a married couple here.
Like,
I was thinking Michael Reese. I need somebody to take a picture of this.
Yeah, I did.
You're getting all right. In my safe space a little bit, Jeff. I got to tell you.
You'll get the...
I don't know. The mic reaches. There's a cable on it.
Okay. All right. Well, look, back and forth then here.
It's nice to see...
I'm a filmmaker. I know how to move the mic back and forth to other people's mouths.
I don't know how often you see each other or the nature of your friendship is, but it's nice to see that 30 years later there's such an affection between you two,
Yeah, it's great. We we're like an old married couple, but yep. we're filmmaker collaborators. We're
right.
partners.
Okay.
So
yeah.
We have this as our legacy, Heavy Metal Parking Lot. We've carried it with us for 30 years. That's that's a length of that's quite a long time.
Right.
And it's certainly a long time in a career wise to have a 30-year run of something.
Right. Well, discuss that kind of, and it's given birth to a few knockoffs, I guess you could say, and your own sequel, right? You just the one, the Neil Diamond?
No. We've really kind of established
made it
a franchise.
Cottage industry.
The cottage industry is right.
Why not?
We kind of just it wasn't intended to be that way. But we basically, as we started recognizing the opportunities that were coming along, it then started to manifest itself.
Right.
And we just kind of have went with it. And some things work, some things don't work.
Or some things work better than others.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. But the fact is, just having the name out there and having that brand, if you will, it's just been terribly gratifying and remains so. And just to have the shelf life with this and so the fact that this is kicking off an anniversary year that has a lot going on, we're doing a lot already. Things are just kind of clicking, and so to have your interest and have the interest of South by Southwest and then beyond, it's just hard to put into words. I mean, I'll do my best effort because I have a big mouth, but I basically...
And you're going to do a lot of 30th anniversaries.
Exactly. John and I are, you know, we just are enjoying the ride.
That's
and,
nice. At what point do you realize, though, that you've touched... It's a touchstone, is that what they call it? At what point do you feel like you've also made something that has struck a chord with the culture like this? What is that? You know, because a lot of documentaries, and I would say even more so to short docs, which don't get nearly enough visibility and exhibition, they're disappear off the map, you know. But this one is there. It's forever there, you know.
Well, I think it's a little easier to reach an audience now in this internet age, but we'll reach back even to the pre-internet age.
Right.
And our eureka moment was 94, when I got out of the blue at my home in Silver Spring, Maryland. I got a call from Sofia Coppola, the filmmaker, actress.
Never heard of her.
Okay.
Yeah. Was she the mother of Francis Ford?
Yes. I think she has a line of fine wines, actually.
No.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yes. Anyway, so Sofia Coppola, yes, of course.
Yes, but she called me. She, you know, pre-internet, she didn't look me up on the web. She found my name in the white pages, 411, gave me a call and to say that she was a big fan. She's calling from Los Angeles, and she's a big fan of Heavy Metal Parking Lot. At that time, she was producing a pilot cable TV series and called High Octane, and it was on which channel?
Well, Comedy Central was where she was doing it for, and she had rented the film at Mondo Video, which was a cult video store in Los Angeles. And that cult video store was really kind of
that.
They were a real important fixture in Los Angeles for many years, renting hard-to-find titles.
Was Tarantino, is that the one he worked at?
He didn't work at that one, no. Colonel Rob Schaffner is the proprietor, and he basically was just really pushing the title. He had traded for it, like it had gotten around by so many means, just all sorts of ways this title was passed around. So Rob got it and was renting it, and that's where Sofia Coppola rented it. And so John got this phone call out of the blue saying she wanted to use it. John, of course, is like, okay. He told me. We both were thrilled. But more than that, we were just astonished that this had gotten into Los Angeles and into this community. John called Mondo Video and talked to Colonel Rob and found out really who had been renting it and how much they had been pushing it and how they were so grateful to hear from us. They continued to be big boosters for it. And that was but that's how she got it. And then at that point, her project didn't go anywhere, unfortunately, but it did all of a sudden give us, the inkling that this was worth getting out of mothballs because we had retired it. We had stopped showing it around 1990. We made it in 1986. There were very few opportunities to screen it.
Because of the length?
Not the length, because film festivals were not taking video at the time. We did this on video with community television equipment from my public access studio that I was running, and we didn't have many opportunities to screen it, which is why, because film festivals only took film, we didn't have the resources or budget to bump it up to celluloid. So it remained on video. It was never shown on public access television because it's rather raw. And quite honestly, John and I from Jump, when we met and started to collaborate around maybe a year before we did Heavy Metal Parking Lot, not even, we were aspiring documentary filmmakers. How's my... Oh, you're letting go of your microphone. Sorry.
Well, you realized.
I thought it was my breath. So you can't imagine how close we're sitting next to each other. But no, what happened was the title... I mean, well, the thing was is we were aspiring documentary filmmakers, and we just didn't have many opportunities to share it except for just videotape trading. We weren't trading it. We were just giving it away if anybody wanted a title and a copy. Right. We had a few outlets for screening it with video projection, but by 1990... And this was Joe only in the Washington, D.C. area where we were living. Mm-hmm. We stopped in 1990 showing it. And then what happened, you know, we traced it in hindsight. A friend of mine came to my job at Discovery Channel where I worked, which was in the – which is Discovery was based in Maryland, and I had a job there at this time. He asked – he said, hey, his name's Mike Heath, and he was moving to California. Can he get copies of Heavy Metal Parking Lot? We just, sure, how many you want? I probably gave him four, and that was it. And he's our Johnny Appleseed because it got into the entertainment business through him, through the music, to the music community, to the bands, etc. It really started with him, and the tape trading sprung from there. So John got this phone call in 94. That's when we realized we had something worth continuing to screen. And that's pretty much where it started. But the underground film festivals, the alternative film festivals that were then taking video did not happen until like the 97. So that's when we started. And at that point, we also had a sequel we cooked up, Neil Diamond Parking Lot. Mm-hmm. And so we really started this, you know, franchise.
Right. It became bigger.
Bigger, right, as it just grew.
How do you guys – so you guys are both from Maryland. Let me lay a little groundwork because I didn't do it at the top. You're both from Maryland or are you both there for a long time?
We're both native Marylanders.
And so because of the peripheral noise, one has to hold it a little closer than normal.
Sure.
So, but you're doing great. I can hear you well.
Yeah, we're both Maryland born and bred. I'm from the Baltimore area. Mm-hmm. Jeff's from Bowie, Maryland, which is considered a suburb of Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
I went to film school. Northwestern University.
Okay.
Jeff went to the University of Maryland, and at that point in time, we were both, you know, aspiring filmmakers, and we had both films, day jobs, in the television production business, sort of lower level, you know, entry level types of jobs. So we would, you know, we would be creatively inspired, and we, you know, at that point in time. You know, you had to go to kind of great lengths and use a lot of resourcefulness to make films, resourcefulness or invest your own money, really, to rent equipment. It wasn't really readily available. This is, you know, even before the prolific, you know, the easy access to consumer video cameras. They weren't really even in the early 80s, they weren't that available, and the quality kind of sucked. It was VHS. We got ourselves access through the public access TV studio that Jeff worked at. We got access to 3/4 inch video equipment. VHS was considered half inch, 3/4 inch was considered professional grade.
Right.
And so we were able to go out and shoot, borrow this equipment and shoot some documentaries, music videos, and Heavy Metal Parking Lot was one of our earlier projects.
How did that come? Do you remember how that idea came to you? Or, oh, by the way, and then your roles also on Heavy Metal were co-directors or?
More or less.
Co-producer,
we were co-filmmakers,
things
really.
Leaked,
You know, I took directorial credit just because I did the editing on it, and I didn't really feel that I needed to put an editor's role in the end credits, really. It was just a collaborative effort. You know, it's just us two. We felt like we contributed equal amounts. Because the camera setup was a two-person camera rig. It was a big, clunky camera, and then even a bigger, clunky tape recorder deck, that video tape recorder that you slung over your shoulder.
Yeah.
And, of course, a mic. We had mics with cables, and we had to, you know, wrangle that as we were moving around the parking lot. So it was a two-person operation. And we interchanged. We handed the camera and the microphone back and forth. You'll hear both our voices on the soundtrack. We never appear on camera except for maybe a couple frames where the camera kind of slides over and you see Jeff's profile in there. But
that beautiful profile of his.
Yeah.
So do you remember the moment, though, where you just thought, oh, this could be a real fun idea? For those who haven't seen it or haven't seen in a long time. There's some B-roll, I guess you could call it, also at the beginning, right, where people are arriving and things of that nature. But you're really watching metalheads
in a parking lot.
In a parking lot waiting for the concert, right?
And then tailgate partying.
Tailgate partying.
It's a pretty simple premise.
It is, but and then because of the nature of this particular subculture, metalheads, I don't know what else to call it. I don't know if that term was available in the 80s. I don't know if
it
that
was actually.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I'd say it was.
Okay.
Well, I'd say it wasn't.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Sorry. It was definitely
sorry,
it was definitely a title that was
okay.
used. It was a
proudly.
Name. Yeah, everybody considered if you were a metalhead, you know, you wore that badge proudly and
right.
you know, with,
so this was a Judas Priest concert.
Judas Priest were playing at the Capitol Center. John
in Maryland.
In Maryland, the Capitol Center was like could be anywhere USA with
right.
the arena.
That's true.
It was but the thing was we were from this area. We came up going to concerts. We went to concerts at the Capitol
yes.
Center.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, colloquially known as the Cap Center, that was, we knew that environment, but
right.
we were not heavy metal fans, per se. We were not metalheads.
Oh, right, you know, it does matter.
But we had an appreciation for concert going, and at the time, you know, it was like the Headbangers Ball and MTV, you kind of, and this kind of music
Spheres
could fill
did,
arena.
Had she done,
I'm sorry?
Had Penelope
yes,
Spheres.
Well, Penelope Spheres, no, she had done, obviously, Decline. Part one was a huge influence on us. Both John and I were very inspired by the decline of Western civilization. And, in fact, our great influences were Penelope Spheres, John Waters. John worked on Polyester, actually.
Oh, wow.
And so when we met, we had very similar tastes, very similar interests, which is why we clicked as collaborators. And I was running this public access studio, and I invited John to come over, and you know, we just kind of had a great interest in the same kind of sensibilities and filmmaking,
yeah.
And we're inspired by a lot of the same things. So to us, John, I had this gear because I was running this public access studio, and outside, it was my first job. You know, I was working for the cable company out of college, and John had graduated from college. John had graduated not long before, and we basically, John, you had the idea where it came from. We still don't know. It just
yeah,
you had
it
the
was
idea.
One of those things,
I had the equipment.
Right.
The thing was, he said like Judas Priest were coming only because you heard it on the radio. It's not like we had this circle penciled. You know, we
right.
had it didn't circle on
it
the
was
calendar.
Spontaneous,
it's spontaneous. That this band was going to play on a Saturday night in May. It was a beautiful spring night, and we just it was such. Pure dumb luck,
right?
Because Judas Priest, it could have been any band. I mean, they were the quintessential, and still
heavy
are
metal
heavy
band.
Metal band, and they're still current. Their music still holds up. And then you had people in this video talking about Metallica and Madonna. You know,
right.
artists that are still viable and current.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It is. It was a total wonderful. I can't even. It just is amazing how it all came together because these are the things that have really helped sustain it.
Right.
But
that's right. I see.
But so Judas Priest, it was just a lucky accident that we were there. We spent 2 hours in the parking lot. We paid our way like you would any concert goer. We got this gear out. We honestly were a little intimidated because we didn't know what might happen. We
right.
weren't sure if we would, people would felt harassed or take offense to us taping them. Everybody was. Nobody said no. Nobody. I mean, there might have been.
You had to get releases and all.
What's that?
Okay.
No, we just never. This was not.
I understand.
You know, we were pretty green at the time.
Right.
I mean, we had visions for careers in this, but we weren't being mentored. Or we weren't being advised. We just kind of went around and
right.
kind of. Also, since it was through community television, there was kind of a. And I had been in the trenches in college radio not long before. I mean, that was a great influence to me, my college radio station at University of Maryland, WMUC. I had become really inspired by just free-form programming, and that kind of, I took that sensibility towards this television career I was interested in pursuing, which was at the cable company. So no, I have no. There were no releases. We didn't.
Never did.
We never thought about it. It just was
what
like.
What happens with that? Does it just sort of expire?
Well, I don't think we thought about it. We thought about it after the fact. like many years later, because we never had a vision for selling
it.
We never had a plan.
Did you ever? So it never came up because you never had a theatrical release and sell tickets to it?
No. We never had any agenda. We never had any vision for this.
I know, but I'm just wondering why it never.
It was a legal issue
for you.
I think a lot of the legal attorneys, let's say, who've gotten involved over the years. Well, I don't know. I mean, gee, we had Cowboy Pictures. Remember them, Noah Cowan and John Vanko? They were, they basically had this distribution company, Cowboy Pictures.
Okay.
I mean, I'm getting ahead of ourselves here quite a bit, because in 2002, they actually bumped the film up to celluloid to pair it with Chris Smith's home movie, which was his follow-up to American Movie,
right,
which was and that toured in theaters. It was a theatrical, you know.
At
that point, kind of the gray areas were being defined. Not that they weren't before, but you could at this point kind of, as pre-internet or as the internet video, the genie was out of the bottle, you know, and so things were being just taken, left and right were being exploited.
Yeah,
and you were just kind of waiting to see what might happen. In this case, they just went ahead with it and paired commercially, theatrically, it did have a small run through legitimate means. It never was a stumbling point, the fact that we never got releases, and it really doesn't stumble. It's not a stumbling point to this day. I hope I don't, jinx it right now.
No. Well,
but yeah.
If there's anything sensitive, you let me know.
No, believe me.
Okay.
We're fine.
Yeah. No, I imagine 30 years in.
Most of the people that are in it that we've met, and we have met quite a few.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
Most
too.
Of the people, it's a real badge of honor to them.
Yeah,
I mean,
they
look at that as a lot
they
of
they know
are,
you haven't gotten rich off of
well,
it.
Well, we haven't gotten rich. We haven't even gotten close to, paying our rent or
we're paying, we're funding ourselves to come here,
No, well, everybody
is quite a bit out of pocket.
Everybody is. Everybody at this festival is, But it's still good for your film.
No, it's great for us, and we're very happy to be here, and we're really just happy to have this chance to celebrate. But, regarding the people that are in it and the fact that we didn't get releases at the time, it's never really held us up, because most everybody has been that we have made contact with, and it's now over 20 of the people, easily.
How many were there roughly, do you think?
I don't know. I've never done an accurate count, but I probably maybe 30 to 40 to 50 faces. Nah, I can't even. I tell you, maybe 30 marquee individuals. I mean, these might be people that are just on camera for 10 seconds.
Right.
40 people. We know over 20. We know half of them by now.
Right.
I mean, just because the internet's helped find them.
Do they have credits? I can't recall.
No, we don't give anybody credit because we don't know their names.
Right. Okay.
We just don't even have. I mean, some of these people are only on for seconds.
Right. No,
but because what they say is so profound, and it just was the stuff has become like some of these sayings are just. They're kind of they're for all time. They're just these statements that have almost become archetypal.
Well, let's talk about that for a second too, because this line between when you're shooting these guys who are
exploitive or what?
I'm sure even though you guys might have been sensitive to how you portrayed these guys, women and men, who other people under certain circumstances may laugh at. Like the same way we laugh at a mockumentary like Spinal Tap, we might laugh at these kids because they're incredibly in love and with the music, and they're so excited and so enthusiastic.
And some are really
and then there's that, right? So they may come off foolish.
Right.
So speak to
but
that.
But it wasn't. That was not our intention.
We never
never meant to mock them. And I think what helps is that we kind of set them up and let them go. We don't goad them through our questioning to say something stupid.
You don't lead them along into. Right.
What's that?
Yeah, you don't lead them along.
No, I don't. I don't lead them along.
Right.
So it seems very naturalistic, almost anthropological, what they're saying, and so it isn't particularly exploitive, really, for the most part. And then what they're saying, I think what keeps this thing alive and what keeps people entertained by this is what they say is just so brash that really, to this day, it really makes an imprint on you. It really registers to the viewer.
Right.
And even, 30 years later, people's jaws still drop when they watch this film.
Right.
And I think it was the style of editing also. I just went for kind of, not necessarily shock value, but let's just follow up one crazy thing with even another crazier soundbite.
Yeah.
It just keeps building on. And really, as you move through the 15-minute film, it's like you're really getting an aural assault, and it's just, you know, it's nonstop, really.
You said you were in touch with about half of the people, and I'm wondering, like, all these years later, I'm sure many of them have matured, let's put it that way, and have lived lives. And looking back on it, what's their current reflection on themselves back then?
Well, fortunately, most of them have gone on to live really productive, happy, successful lives. And to a large extent, a lot of them are still metalheads. And
right.
Now we're looking at people who were like 16, 17 years old when they went on camera. Now they're like in their mid-40s. And they're still you know, living the life and rocking it. I mean,
I don't like hearing that they're still younger
than me. Well, I don't know if they're living the life. They're
so
not
even now. They're younger than I am now. I thought these guys would be in their 50s.
Well,
some of them
were in our 50s. So
right.
Yeah, I mean, most of them are. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'd say most were. If they probably were 5 years younger than us. I'm just speaking generally.
Right.
I don't know. You know, because we were 25. I was 25. We're about this. John and I are, you know, the same age.
Some of them had to be around the same age as you, and some of them really are teenagers.
Right, exactly,
still high school.
Exactly. Right. And some are, yeah. So I'd say there's really a 10-year back and forth. I mean,
right.
You know, some were high school, some were, you know, out of high school. There was, you know, I don't know. There's one guy who, you know, we call him the hairy man because he's just wearing a tank top, you know, and he's really hirsute, you know, and he you know, the popular lore is that he was a substitute teacher at a local high school, but I've never found any confirmation. We haven't heard from him yet, but basically most people are roughly are. But yeah, like John said, everybody's going on to productive lives, families. Most are still into the music, not all, but you know, or they've just broadened their tastes and, you know, are more open to other things. I mean, they might have been at the time, but that was the music that they were most passionate about. I think, yeah, as you get older, your tastes do change and you do just kind of open up to other things, and who knows. But I think it's the gratifying thing is that so many of the people that we do know are really fond of this. Of their appearance in this, and wear it as a badge of honor, and you know, we're just delighted that they feel that way, and that I consider them all family. I mean, I really do. I really am very you know, protective of them, and feel very kindly and are very appreciative that they in the first place shared, you know, their enthusiasm on camera with us, because this film is really about them. I mean, it's they're the stars. You know, John and I are the conduit, but they're the ones that make it.
Yeah.
And so I just am, you know, I'm really happy that we know a lot of them. We're hoping to have many of them come to screenings throughout certainly in the Washington and Maryland area when we're screening there. And we have plans. We're having a gallery exhibit. I've donated my archive to my alma mater, University of Maryland, and we're going to have an exhibit opening right around the time of the 30th anniversary in 2 months. At a gallery on campus that is going to have, it's going to open May 27th of this, you know, in 2 months. Well, right now this is March, and so end of May, right around the time of the 30th anniversary, we will have this year-long exhibit open.
What's the day of the anniversary?
The remember? Anniversary is May 31st, 1986.
We'll post that in time with that.
Oh, good. Yes.
And that makes sense. And then we can also plug your, in case we have any friends in Washington, D.C.
Great.
Area, or in the points north and around.
Terrific. Well, the exhibit will be up for a year, and the exhibit's called Heavy Metal Parking Lot.
Maybe I'll come.
The 30-year journey of a cult film sensation, which is really, I love that. I love the fact that they've embraced it and they're accepting my collection.
That's
John
great.
And I are both, you know, sharing in this exhibit. What's on display? Well, let's be the first to publicly acknowledge here on FilmWax that we have actually, we have pieces of the actual parking lot from the Capitol Center that John, the Capitol Center was torn down in 2002,
okay.
And it's been replaced by a shopping center. The arena in that area moved downtown to Washington, D.C., out of the suburbs, so the actual Capitol Center is no more, and we witnessed the implosion of it, which took place in 2002, and before it was torn down, John was out there picking up asphalt from the parking lot,
sure.
And we're going to have that on display, among other things.
Well, you figure, you know, for all those years of picking up ass, at that arena. Now that people are picking up asphalt, so it's
that's
it's
all that was left for it.
Yeah.
So we have the actual parking lot.
Wow.
That's one.
Hey, I have two other questions come to mind real quick, and one is so people should, by the way, if you're listening, go check out this exhibit show if you're in the capital area. The question, next one, did Judas Priest? Do you ever get to meet Judas Priest or Rob Halford? Did you?
Rob Halford. No.
Yeah, we have a pretty good story about that. We were, back in '88, which is 2 years after we produced Heavy Metal Parking Lot. Judas Priest came back to the D.C. area on a major tour to play the same exact concert arena, and we decided we would. We got ourselves invited backstage to the our purpose, our main goal was to show the band Heavy Metal Parking Lot. You know, actually haul in a videotape recorder and a TV set.
Uh-huh.
We couldn't play it back on a phone at that point in time, and set it up and backstage right before the show them the video. Our other intention was to show the video to the entire 16,000 concert goers on the big jumbotron.
Would have been biggest audience
before the that for us would be reaching a huge audience and a huge appreciative audience to show it right before the concert, get it really pumped up. It would have been an amazing experience. Just to make the story a little shorter, the arena management who ran the TV production facilities there and provided the TV feed shot it down. They wouldn't let us show the video in front of a huge audience because they thought it showed the concert arena, the Capitol Center, in a bad light. And we were essentially showing illegal
drunk?
And immoral behavior.
They're getting high in the parking lot. Right.
In the parking lot,
gotcha.
So they didn't want to kind of hurt their image.
I understand.
And then the other thing that didn't quite work out is we tried to, we got ourselves backstage. We walked by the dressing room. We saw the band in there relaxing. Eating fresh fruit before they're going to go on stage. But then they ushered us into the hockey players' locker room to set up our little TV set. And the only people from the band that they brought in to watch the video was some band management.
The tour manager and the accountant.
And these were the only, basically the head roadie and the accountant came in and they gave us, 15 minutes out of their precious time to watch our video, and they were pretty nonplussed by it
that's disappointing.
End of story. Yeah. Well, not quite the end of story. We did drop off a couple of VHS tapes with the band to take with them.
We kind of took a risk because we honestly borrowed their music. We just like we didn't get releases from the people in the film. We also
did you use significant parts though?
We've significant use of their music in the film. And so that's a risk right there. But we never had a plan to sell this. We always had a plan to, it was just a tribute to the fans, tribute to that kind of the sheer exuberance of going to a concert, which everybody can appreciate regardless of what kind of music you like or what you were into.
Yeah.
It was kind of
being
young, exactly.
All that asphalt.
Yes, the asphalt, everything that really was kind of just makes it kind of still a touchstone for people.
Magic, right?
Yeah, we were kind of throwing ourselves like, look, we did this for the fans, we did this for the band. Here you go. All we wanted to do was show it on the telescreen, and they were pretty cordial, although they were nonplussed, like John says. And so we gave them copies to take with them and thought, well, if we're going to hear from them and hear any kind of,
a cease and desist
about using their music, we'll hear it after we
give
them these copies. And we heard nothing. So that was like, all right, well, if we didn't hear anything, fine. We'll just continue to screen it and show it. And basically, that's always been the case. We, to this day, don't have any relationship with them, but they're always, or frequently, they're asked about it in interviews.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
So they're aware of it?
They're aware of it. They're very complimentary about it. They're very, cordial and kindly towards it and saying, well, that's our fans. Never reference us as filmmakers about it.
Understood.
They just know that the title's out there and that, yes, that's our fans and that show, that's still going on.
Right.
To a man, and this is on TV. They're asked about it on MTV. Over the years, in print, in different interviews, and so we're very pleased that that's the relationship we have.
Right.
And they also used some clips in their official anniversary video they did, and like it's called Metalworks. It was came out in like I don't know 93 or 94 whatever.
Not long after.
It was a VHS. Okay. Well, that was
So actually, they used your footage.
They
now,
used about a handful of clips of it.
You didn't provide those?
Well, that was must have been from the videos we left with them.
Oh,
or
that's
something.
Funny.
We never heard. So they took from us, and they're welcome to that.
It was nice that you didn't sue them for using footage of them that you didn't borrow or get permission to
use. So they took some of the fan footage, and
it was quid pro quo.
That's right. Exactly.
And the last thing I wanted to mention, and I was having a conversation about this very thing, about the pressure for now in this day and age when documentaries are now, you know, this enormous thing, part of the film world, which was not the case in the early, mid-80s. There were virtually no documentary filmmakers, and there were or distribution. My question is now, because, you know, so many filmmakers that are making documentaries, and maybe you would be facing this yourself if you were to make the film today, that you need to make a feature-length film because you have to get that you have to make a feature-length film because so few shorts would have any kind of momentum,
traction.
Get any traction.
Yeah.
Exactly. So forget the, even the festivals, broadcast, theatricals, all these different platforms are really made for 75 to 90-minute films, and you here made a 17-minute film. But having said that, my point is a lot of those 85-minute films should be 17 minutes and are not.
Yeah.
The question should have been, why didn't you make this into feature length back in 84, 85, whatever?
Well, we didn't have a game plan to do that, and we didn't have...
And it was on video, so I kind of thought maybe technical reasons...
Well, no, we didn't. We only had... I mean, the tapes were 20-minute tapes, U-matic tapes. We just borrowed surplus tape, which was the kind of par for course, I mean, which is unbelievable. It's unheard of today. If you're making a film, you don't even use tape anymore, you know. It's digital, but basically we didn't have... Plus, it was, you know, where would a... I mean, quite honestly, if I knew back then what I know now, I never would have turned the camera off in my life, you know,
right.
Because it's just, you have all... That's the thing. We're documented at this time.
And you would
period.
Have all this ancillary...
Exactly.
Ancillary
content.
Footage, which would have value...
Exactly, as archival footage.
Right, right.
I mean, we've over the years had, you know, opportunities to share that, our footage in different documentaries. About metal, about the music time, the time scene of the 80s. Because, yeah, nobody was documenting anything like they do now. Nowadays, everything's just endlessly documented on tape with your phone. But back then, nobody had video cameras, and certainly nobody was taping the people in the parking lot of a concert. So, I mean, you had mentioned earlier Penelope Spheeris, and I said she was an influence. And, yes, John and I were inspired by both Decline Part 1 and Part 2. And she even in Part 2 interviewed some fans.
Punk. Part 2 was punk.
Well,
right?
Part 1 was punk. Part 2 was metal.
Right.
And that came out in the late 87 or 88, I'm trying to think.
Mm-hmm. Part 2?
Part 2 did, but she obviously shot it before that. So she was shooting it probably around the same time we were shooting Heavy Metal Parking Lot. But she'd done something with punk. She'd already done this kind of verite this documentary, this film that totally was a terrific influence on John and I. We were so inspired, and her work is even narrative work was really influential to us. So we sent her tape when we made Heavy Metal Parking Lot. We sent two copies to two people, John Waters, who John had a relationship with, and Penelope Spheeris, who we were friends with, and they both wrote back. You know, well, John Waters sent us a wonderful postcard to John Hine saying that the film gave him the creeps. And that was a quote we used liberally.
see it as a good marketing.
Yes, so
John Waters
said
now.
It gave me the creeps.
Yeah.
Then Penelope Spheeris called us both at our jobs and was really just very complimentary and just very encouraging. And to this day, that just means the world to me that she took the time then. And so, yeah, I guess my point was regarding the kind of filmmaker, just taking the camera out and documenting fans and doing things. There weren't many people doing it. And so, like, she did, you know, we did. I guess we didn't invent it, but we've been, we're very happy to be pioneers of this.
Maybe.
We are thinking more along the lines of long-form documentaries
that
now.
Question.
Yeah. Sorry. You totally drifted.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah. No, it's still.
I'm cutting to the chase because I'm a storyteller and I tell stories really concisely. I just throw a lot of footage ends up on the cutting room floor. Heavy Metal Parking Lot could have been a little bit longer. We have some outtakes and they're half decent, but they really didn't quite make the cut.
Right.
But there was still not enough there to make a feature-length film. But now we're making films, and Jeff has released a film called Led Zeppelin Played Here. It's a feature-length documentary.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another film called along the lines. There's another film called Heavy Metal Picnic, which is also a feature-length documentary.
Okay.
Which also explores the heyday of heavy metal in Maryland.
Or hair bands.
Yes.
Right. So the thing was, but why we didn't do it at the time, it just wasn't. There wasn't enough material. We didn't have a vision for it.
Right.
We frankly didn't even know what we were getting when we went out there to tape that one day.
Sure.
So we're not really doing shorts anymore. We're trying to grow as filmmakers, and as you said, feature films are the way to go.
Right.
It's part of your professional personal growth as a filmmaker, and then also if you want to get an audience, you have to make your feature
precisely
film.
Right. Yeah. And it helps.
Yeah,
sure.
And for our 20th, we actually created a DVD for Heavy Metal Parking Lot.
That was my last question:
how people can see it now. You can actually go online and just Google it. The thing is,
YouTube.
It's out there on. We have it on Snag Film. Officially, but we also people post it on YouTube. It's and we have it on through our website. You can watch it on heavymetalparkinglot.com.
Oh, I think I have a copy of it on DVD.
I
think I got a copy. I bought a copy.
Or you might have had one. I mean, yeah. I'm happy to give you
one.
It has
the Judas Priest title. Design.
Yeah,
doesn't it?
It's right here.
Kim's Video used to sell it and rent it, so maybe that's where you got it.
I don't know. But
I don't know if you have one.
That's what I have.
Do you have this? Well,
but I don't have. I should have brought it because I could get it autographed.
Well, hey, we'll give you another.
All right. And then I'll sell the other one.
But that's right. The thing is, we made a 20th anniversary DVD.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing was, is for a 16-minute documentary. This is a 2-hour DVD.
Oh, okay.
So we have tons of extra stuff. We did a lot. We have the sequels. We've got other stuff that we made.
I'm going to rewatch it, I think.
We basically... So as far as a feature length, there's a lot of content. There's so much...
Well, as you're kind of pointing out, the world has changed so much because of the, internet that you can now... You can sell something like this. There's more to it. It's not just the film itself. So you can still spend a couple of hours... enjoying the whole...
Immerse yourself
in this documentary. It's terrific.
We have a heavy metal collector named Jim Powell. We did a documentary called Heavy Metal Basement.
Right.
And that's just a tour of his collection. And he's talking about Judas Priest music. And that's on there. There's also, the alumni. We have you meet about 5 different people who were in the film.
Right.
That's on here.
20 years later.
Right.
Yeah.
And so everything. So we just continue to grow with it and continue to... work with it, and now having a chance to celebrate the 30th anniversary, here we are launching our 30th anniversary year.
And thank you for making time to come on the podcast. It's a
thank
pleasure,
you, Adam,
and to meet you both.
Absolutely, likewise.
Thank you, Adam. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, John Hine and Jeff Krulik. Coming up on the podcast, Joel Fendelman and Frank Paul Green have a film called Remittance. It just played at the Brooklyn Film Festival. We're going to play that episode for you, that segment for you. Joel's been on the podcast before, as has Frank, with 2 different projects, but they've come together on this project, so I had to bring them on. And that film is called Remittance, and we're going to talk to those guys. And also, Brent Barber, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, is the founder of the Bicycle Film Festival, which is going to start in just a matter of days. The film festival runs from June 22nd through the 26th at the Anthology Film Archives, and it's films about bikes and biking. Go figure. I mean, not go figure. It's 16 years. It's a huge culture around biking. So it is going to be at the Anthology Film Archives. So check out their website, thebicyclefilmfestival.com, and we'll get that episode up as soon as we can in order to help that festival along a little bit. And we're bringing on all sorts of other friends in the coming days. We'll have on Paul Azar, the actor, is returning to the podcast. We're going to play an episode with Lizzie Borden, the filmmaker. Oh, and then there's an episode coming up with Josh Bishop, who's also returning to the podcast. And the Made in Japan was the film that he talked about last year, and he's back with a new documentary called Dwarvenant, which is in festivals right now, and we'll have Josh Bishop back on the show as well. And many surprises. I'm working on a couple of huge names. I'm very excited about it, but I don't want to announce it or jinx it, so I'm going to wait till it's in the can and we're raring to go, much like my episode with John Turturro, which I'm got to get up as soon as possible. Please give us go to iTunes and give us a star rating and leave a comment. You know, it's really integral to the success of the show, and is being highlighted on iTunes, and that can do wonder of good for the show. And I need my listeners to all go to iTunes and give us a star rating, a favorable one. If 5, for instance, would be nice, just as an example. Or leave a nice comment, if you will, and you can also like us on Facebook, or interact and engage with us on Facebook, facebook.com/filmwaxradio. We're on Twitter under Film Wax Radio, as well as Instagram. There's so many ways of getting in touch with us here at the podcast. I want to thank everybody on the show today, as well as I want to thank the producer here at Showbriz Studios, where we're recording, Alex Brazell, and Charlotte Williams, of course, who's interning for FilmWax Radio this summer, and you, my listeners, and, of course, the folks at Casper.com. Thanks again for sponsoring this episode. Until next time, take care. And their nation now.